Well, this Upanishad has a historical place, of course, about 200 AD, and there's a famous work which goes with it called the Karika, which again is thought to be something like 600 AD. And on those two, on the Upanishad and the Karika, Sri Shankara, whom we follow here, of whom our teacher was a most faithful follower, did a commentary. The Upanishad is very short, only 12 verses. Sri Shankara calls it the essence of the Upanishads, and our teacher's teacher, Sri Dada, also says this is one of the three Upanishads which, if studied, will give the whole of the spirit of those Upanishads. The waking state, the dreaming state, and the dreamless sleep state. Now, these are regarded as the key concepts of the beginning of the Upanishad. The first state is awareness of external things. Shankara doesn't use the word waking state in his commentary. He says things are seen externally. Then the next state, he says, when you look at things, you see them externally. Now close your eyes and see those same things in your memory, clearly. And he says, as if it were a dream. Now this, he says, is the second state, the state of interior light, cognition, interiorly. And he says this is as if in a dream. And he repeats it, as here, so in a dream. Dream is one example of it. But in the other case, in the waking state, as we call it, we are also dreaming all the time, because when we are seeing the outer objects, we also have inner pictures, as every salesman knows. He sees the prospect, as he calls them, and at the same time he has an inner picture of what he's going to get out of it. This is a dream, even while waking. Then the third state, the Upanishad says, is a state where there's no cognition, either external or internal. It's a mass of consciousness. We would think, no, that's unconsciousness. But the point is made by Sri Shankara here and in many other places that if it were unconscious, we would never know about it. But we do have the awareness. I was in deep sleep. I knew nothing. We say, oh, well, that's not the same thing as not knowing, as being unconscious. But the analysis is very precise here. Knowing nothing is not the same as not knowing. A statement can be made. There was nothing there. If we don't know, we can't make a statement. I think an example which is given from modern biology is the snakes have a pit in the cheeks which registers heat. And they can tell whether there's a mouse in the room. They can sense the heat, the mouse. So if you put a snake in a room, it turns its head like that. The room's absolutely dark, it turns its head like that. And then if there's no mouse, it goes to sleep. It heat senses nothing. And it knows there's no mouse there. Now if we are put in a dark room, we don't know whether there's a mouse there or not. We don't know whether to go to sleep or not. Might be a mouse. So a great point is made of this in the yoga psychology. Gaudapada says that this state goes on all the time because this is the state of not knowing. And all the time in our ordinary empirical experience, there is the consciousness of external objects, then there's an inner light by which we see internal objects, and then lastly, there's a state where we don't know. There's a layer of ignorance. We don't know, as they say, where we came from or where we're going to. There's ignorance, and this is the state of deep sleep, which is continuing all the time that we are going around. And Shankara extends these verses of the Upanishad to include not only the strict state of dream, but also the internal visualizations and plans and pictures which we make. They are the second state, which is of light. And the next point is, Om is all this. And we think, well, these are just words. They can't mean anything at all. How can a word, even a name, how can a name be a thing? Well, some examples are given. One of them can be like this. This is a picture of a dancing girl. She's carrying a flute and she's wearing silk garments here, undergarments which you can just see forming a V there, made of cotton. Her hair is parted in the middle, comes down to the back there. Her hands are holding the flute. She's obviously not playing it yet. She's going to bring it to her lips. You can tell how old she is by the length of the sleeves. She's under 20. So that there are a great many things here. But in fact, all these things are simply names. There's no flute there, no hands there, no hair there. There's no silk dress there. It's simply the clay. It's the names that actually are these things. Well, we can say, ah, yes, true. But that's only because there really are such things. It's only because such things really exist, those long sleeves really exist. The under 20 girls of a particular profession in Kyoto wear them. They're the entertainers and they're dancers and singers. So it's only because they exist that we project them onto here. But that isn't so. If we see, for instance, the picture of a Chinese dragon, it's quite familiar to us and to all Chinese. Now, such things have never existed, but they've been created by pictures and words and names, and we can recognize them. And sometimes when people are in delirium, they get the feeling that a dragon is trying to get into the house as the wind rattles the window. It becomes real to them. The things can be created by names and words. There is a Chinese and Japanese legend of a bird whose feathers are so beautiful and pure that the heavenly beings beg this bird for them to make their feather robes, and the bird will give feathers and then it grows new ones. And this also is a creation of names, and words and pictures. And it's familiar and it's recognized by the people in this tradition. Shankara says that in the same way, if things are created by names, and the names are the things, then he says it is a disease to take these things which are names as real. And we suffer from it, from this disease, and that it's cured by knowing that they are creations of name. And he says that this is done by meditation on the self. And he quotes the Maitri Upanishad in his commentary here. As the self, worship Om. Worship Om as the self, because in Om all the names are included and transcended. And then he gives another. As self alone, he is to be worshipped. And this text, which often comes in Shankara's writings, from the Brihad it comes originally, he often calls knowledge, as he does in this commentary. And we can say, as self alone, he is to be worshipped. Not simply thought of, but worshipped. If we just think of a thing, we separate ourselves from it. In worship, we go towards it. And people think, oh, well, we don't want to worship these days. Surely man can stand by himself now. Well, we think so. But in actual fact, it isn't so. There are people who certainly, when they're met, even though they may not be religious, they do give this sense of benevolence. Top American ambassador is probably not a particularly gullible man, rather cynical. But on meeting the head of a particular state, a father of his people, he said of him, his brown eyes exceedingly wise and kind. And he's the sort of man that a child would want to sit on his lap, and a dog would instinctively sidle up to him. And of another, such a prominent man, a dean, a Christian. He said, this man was not a Christian, but he said of him, the moment you talk of other people's struggles, of other people's difficulties, his whole face lights up. Concern immediately comes over him. I felt ashamed when I saw this exhibition in this man who is an atheist, but in him I saw the true spirit of Christianity. First of those two, the man whose eye was exceedingly wise and kind, on whose lap a child would want to sit, a dog would instinctively sidle up to, that was Stalin, as seen through the eyes of the American ambassador Biddle. And the second one was Chairman Mao, who killed more people, they now think, than Hitler and Stalin together, as seen through the eyes of the Dean of Canterbury, Hewlett Johnson. In other words, they needed something to worship, and they began worshipping there. The personality cult is formed, and it's worshipped. In China, the country was being destroyed, and people knew it. But they went on worshipping the personality cult. Dora Russell, who founded a school, admittedly it was a disastrous failure, but still she was a considerable thinker in her own right and a great idealist. She began worshipping Chairman Mao. And sometimes you feel these people who are at the focus of personality cults, something gets into them and they begin to think, well, how far could you go? What wouldn't they stand? And she quotes with approval in one of her books on education some remarks by Chairman Mao on education. And he said, people are against cheating. But the fact is that if one pupil gets the answers right and another pupil peers over and copies what he's written and gets his answers right, well, then he's a right and he should get full marks. So she quotes this, she says, Chairman Mao is sometimes quite unexpected. And he then said, and it was all right too, to pay somebody to take your place in the examination. He said, that shows enterprise. And he said about examination questions, that the Dream of the Red Chamber is a great Chinese classic. He said, set questions on this, and one pupil answers them all correctly from his textbook. But only give him 50% because he's mechanically copying. And another one answers them more or less out of his head. Perhaps he hasn't read the book, but he sort of invents the book. Well, mark him up because he's been creative. And she writes these down. She's worshipping. With part of her head, she knows that it's absolute nonsense. But because she's worshipping, she needs something to worship, and she follows him. Now, so Shankara says it's essential. You have to worship. And in some of his commentaries, in some places of his commentaries, he's very frank. The opponent is allowed to speak very forcibly. And the opponent says, you see, your worship and meditation, finally, is on identity, isn't it? Yes. Yes, you worship Om, and finally, it's an identification. And the opponent says, well, look, you see, in these some of these rituals, you're told to meditate on the sacrificial post as the sun. Well, you do this. You think of somehow the sacrificial post as the splendour of the sun and it's taking part in the holy ceremony. But all the time, you know perfectly well that it isn't. And your meditations are just like that. It's like a man who sees a stump of a tree and thinks that that's a man. Say he's lost in a mist. He needs to find someone to ask the way, and he hopes, and then he sees this thing about the height and dimensions of a man, so he rushes up to ask the way. He thinks it's a man, but he's wrong. The opponent says your Vedantic meditations are just like that. You're trying by meditation to persuade yourself that the stump of a tree is a man. And all the time, really, you know that it isn't. And Shankara meets this point. He says, it's not like that. Because the scriptures tell us that these meditations which are given are not symbolic, but are facts, are true. And in the Brihadaranyaka 131, the point is discussed at great length. And he points out that to meditate on a fact which is not yet realized is not creating an illusion, but it's truth. And so he, in the meditations here, it says, in the state of seeing exterior things, let him meditate that heaven is his head. The opponent says, but heaven is not the man's head. And Shankara says, no, not as the Sankhyas see the self, circumscribed by the body. But if this meditation is pursued up to the point of knowledge, then he will find it is so. The self is regarded as having four quarters, of being of four quarters. Quarters, which are contained in it, are contained only by imagination, by a vibration of the mind. And therefore you can't see them. They're there. There's a quarter here, which represents the state of the deep sleep, and the state of the interior observation, and the state of the exterior observation. And he says, the people in this state, or when we are in this state, we see external objects and we are satisfied with those objects. To somebody who's, we would call them now, extroverted, the deeper states are simply dreams. It's people just sitting with their mouths open and so on. But sooner or later, they've got to come back and have their dinner, haven't they? Just unreal, just sort of figments of the imagination. But he says, in fact, this is based on this, which is the inner light and the exterior perceptions are based on the inner perception. And the inner perceptions are based on this massed consciousness which is here. But all this is a creation of the vibrations of the mind. But in order to attain realization of the Atman, the true self, which contains them all, he begins here, and he has to, as Shankara says, in samadhi, merge into this one, merge until he loses the external perceptions and becomes entirely internally perceiving. Then internally perceiving, to make a jump away from thought into massed consciousness, and then finally to burn this up. He uses the yogic term to burn the seeds and attain to the Atman. Now he says this, the field of this is the external objects, the field of this is the inner light, the field of this is massed consciousness. But the field of this is not given. But if we look carefully at the commentary, we'll see the field of this is the other three, as well as its own self. Well, our teacher often spoke of this. The third state, which we call deep sleep, but Shankara doesn't call deep sleep in his commentary, not only deep sleep, it's when memory disappears and the mind has been transcended. There's no consciousness of external objects. Then the mind is transcended, no consciousness of internal objects. Sridhara says the same thing. And then finally, the seeds, the impressions, are burnt up by worship and devotion and meditation. And then there's complete realization of Atman. The third state, which we think of as unconsciousness, in fact is called omniscience in the Upanishad. But that omniscience is lost when we return to ordinary life, because the seeds of our ignorance block the manifestation of omniscience. But our teacher often referred to cases of scientists and artists who do succeed in entering that state, still partially concentrated on a particular point. Then they enter that state in which the concentration is completely transcended. But when they come back, the point on which they've concentrated is illumined. He gave many examples, but it's not very satisfactory to hear examples of famous artists and scientists, because you think, well, you've got to have tremendous skill, technical skill or knowledge, to have this sort of inspiration. So some examples from ordinary life can be a very useful thing. The richest man in Japan still is a man who left school when he was 13, no education. But he built up the Matsushita Electric, Panasonic, and this vast empire. His income is so great that the taxes are 90%. He says of himself, he says, I'm making all this money in exports for Japan, but of course it all goes over straight to the government, but they let me keep a service charge of 10%. He's not educated. He says it's got some advantages. He said, when something comes up in business where you've got to see something, he said, my staff read a book about it. I actually go and look at it. And he said, when the problem comes up, they try and find the answer in books, you see. He said, but I have to think, because I have no real education. I'm not really at home in books. But he says one very interesting thing, that he has to, as the president of the company, he has to listen to a tremendous number of these talks on management and on company policy and so on, and the export figures and so on. They do a lot of these in this sort of thing in Japanese companies to create a sort of team spirit. Sony is the enemy, not just a competitor, but the enemy. And they build it up like this. Well, he says that he couldn't understand these talks, you see. He was very successful, but he couldn't understand the talks on how to be successful. And he says that he developed a skill of being able to shut off the voice. He had to be there as the president. He had to sit up in his frock coat and the wing collar and the tie and so on as the president. But he could shut off the voice, and then he could think about the actual problems and ideas for the company. He said sometimes they were very fruitful afterwards, but he had to be able to shut out the voice. Well, this is a yogic technique of quite a high order, and to withdraw from the external consciousness of the external objects into this luminous inner sphere of Taijas. In one of his books, which I read, and they're very interesting, he was having trouble with the newly founded unions, not very long after the war, about 10 or 15 years. And the row was on when the year changed. Well, the New Year holiday, the things closed down. And then on the fourth day, everything opens up. And it's customary then for the president and some of the managers to go make a formal inspection of the whole premises. And everybody's standing there, and it's all been cleaned up, and it's all spruced up, and so on. Well, they thought they'd kind of try him out, as they were having a row, the unions. They deliberately left one of the staff lavatories, the open floor, one place was deliberately left stained and dirty. All the rest perfectly clean, all around. And they wondered what he'd do. And the description said that he was making the rounds, and they came to this place, you see, and then the thrown out, and they stood on the threshold, and then it was perfectly apparent there was this defiled area in the middle, and there was a silence. And then he said something to one of the assistant managers, who scurried off, came back with a bucket of hot water, a big cake of soap, and a scrubbing brush. And the president then got down on his hands and knees and scrubbed the floor, clean, going right on to the end, waving away in the assistant until it was perfectly clean. Then he mopped it up, got up. Well, this made him enormously popular in the company. And it was one example of a sort of inspiration. Now, another one was this. There was a depression in Japan, and all electrical companies were in a bad way. People couldn't afford to buy new stuff. Well, his factory then had 600 people, and they don't like sacking people in Japan, but some of the companies were having to do this. Matsushita called his staff together, explained the situation. He said, we've got this now. You've made these electric stoves and electric kettles and cookers and so on, and we can't sell them because of the depression. So they're piling up. It's no use making any more, is it? We can't sell them. Can't get any turnover. So everybody sort of bowed the head. And then he said, I'm an amateur, you know, in business. But amateurs can do all right. said, I've never had any training or education, some of you have had, but amateurs can do all right. Now, I'll suggest this. All of you, give up what you're doing, making these things, and turn yourselves for a week into salesmen. You don't know anything about selling, but I didn't know anything about electricity when I went into the business. And you can sell these things to the housewives at cost price, so long as we get them moving and turn over, and then we can make some more. So 600 salesmen descended on Osaka. Amateur salesmen carrying these things and selling them at cost price. And his was the one of the few companies that survived the Depression. He was a man who practiced meditation of his own kind. He's an idealist, and he had these inspirations which are most unexpected. And our teacher told us that all the time inspiration is raining on us. Now, his concern was with his company and the welfare of the people in it, but he did receive inspiration for that. In the yoga doctrine, these three are, in a certain sense, created by illusion. And the example our teacher often gave was of a play. And if we remember that illustration, we can understand more easily some of the sort of verbal expressions where they discuss these things. For instance, they'll say, there is no world. No world has been created, actually. So it can't disappear, can it? And you think, well, what's all this? What's all this? If we go to a play of Hamlet, we see there a kingdom with a history. The history goes back before the play begins. There was a murder before the play begins. Was it created? Well, not exactly. It doesn't exactly exist, and yet we see it and we feel with it. It goes on. Then at the end, does it disappear? If it was never there, how could it disappear? Yet in another sense, it does disappear. And our teacher gave the example of the play because it does enable us to understand some of these logical difficulties in explaining a thing which is both real, because it's perceived, and unreal, because it's made up of names and forms. The concluding verses of the Karikas give the methods of realization, and they say the syllables of Om must be realized one after another. The first measure or syllable is Ah, and this corresponds to the state conscious of waking objects. And when it's meditated on, and Shankara uses the word Samadhi, the experience becomes universal. Then heaven is his head. And there are descriptions of this experience in some of the mystic literature of yoga. Then when he meditates on the second, the U, A-U, which joined together into O, then he becomes Hiranyagarbha, which is the cosmic intellect. And he receives inspiration from that because he's now unified with it. And the concentrations that the individual has had now become illumined by inspiration. Then, finally, the last syllable is the which is transcending both consciousness exterior and interior. A jump. This is the blank circle in the Zen pictures. A jump has to be made. We can think, oh, we don't want to go beyond thought. That would be unconsciousness. No. Inspiration, sarvajna, all-knowing, and bliss. And Shankara says this is not the full bliss, the complete bliss, because there is still the seed bed, what we should call the causal body, but here in this text, in his commentary, he calls the seeds. And then when they have been burnt up by the yoga practice, then finally there's the turiya, which is unobstructed, and can, as our teacher said, play at will in any of these states or in none of them. I'll just read the opening verses. The letter Om is all this. All that is past, present or future is verily Om. Whatever is beyond the three periods of time is also verily Om. All this is surely Brahm. This self is Brahm. This self has the four quarters.